the beauty of having to try to make sure that there was good representation, we learned that AI adoption is unevenly distributed across the world. You'll see that adoption is a lot higher in the Western markets and a lot lower when you go to South America, Asia, and Africa.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Media Voices. We're the media-focused B2B podcast that takes a look at absolutely everything to do with the media, from business models right down to some of the ethical concerns that really matter. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston. And that clip you just heard was from my interview with Shepo Chabalala, project manager and team lead at the LSE's Journalism AI project. Yes, AI! I first met Chepo on a News Rewired panel, and I was just struck by the real, you know, and among all this chat about Gen AI and all of this, about the real practical approach that the Journalism AI project was taking. So when I spoke to him, we avoided talking about whether AI was going to steal all our jobs or killing robots and all that stuff. And we really focused on how the Journalism AI project was helping newsrooms get started with emerging tech.
Yeah, phenomenal. And it's something we included in our newsletter the other week. Some practical tips from The City, which is a US-based outlet. So if you are interested in keeping abreast of everything to do with media, from practical AI all the way through to some of the things we're going to be talking about today, you can sign up to our newsletter by going to voices.media. And actually, this story, which we're discussing here, was included in the newsletter on Friday. Now, I was taken aback to see Sydney Sweeney, the actress, in our newsletter. But Esther, what motivated you to include a story about...
Whoa. See, before we even get to that, what you were taken aback by, I was taken aback by Esther's rapidly developing socialist tendencies. We clearly have made an impact here.
Do you know, I did not have enough space in three paragraphs to go into this week.
Well, okay, well, let's start with that. What motivated you to include this? Because it is a very sort of like strident story.
It's quite like, yeah, it went sort of full on like ransack the CEOs and give money back to the sort of poor hardened creators. But when I was reading it, so this is a defective story by Kelsey McKinney. And so this actress has been saying that she's been struggling to, not struggling to live, but that the money coming in is perhaps not what you'd expect for a leading actress.
Struggling to live in her $3 million house.
No. Don't do that, because that's exactly what she's talking about in this.
And the piece does go into that. It says, you know, how can you be struggling if you're in a $3 million house? But it does go into quite a lot of the thing about it's about building up the savings and the fact that Sweeney cannot actually take 6 months worth of break, because she's essentially a freelancer within the industry. I don't know how much she's paid per job. It's probably significantly more than I am.
But she doesn't come from generational wealth, which I think is part of the issue there.
And she says that there's so many people that sort of sworn into the industry, you know, they come in, they take breaks, they can do what they want because they've got that sort of that generational wealth behind them. And the piece actually opens with, you could tell who has and who hasn't, because those that have might post on Instagram once a month from like a glamorous party. Whereas the ones that you can tell who is constantly having to grind, who's having to do the deals, who's having to do the promos and the sponsor posts, because they are working hard. I put this in, it doesn't sound very relevant at the moment, but I did put this in because I saw a lot of parallels with the publishing industry. And there's been quite a few stories over the last 6 months about how difficult it is to make a living, either as a freelance writer or even as a fully employed writer. Because people are saying, you know, even on salaries, they are really struggling to build savings or do anything beyond just sort of live paycheck to paycheck, that's a huge sort of structural issue in Britain, certainly with what's going on with the cost of living and everything else. And some people say, well, we're eating too much avocado toast, we're crap at saving. There's a lot of issues that we could dive into. I'm just not going to touch, because we only have 20 minutes.
That's true. Well, this came up in that House of Lords panel I watched, and what's his name, Wright from DMG Media, he basically said, he highlighted to the panel, oh, in fact, it's really, really hard for young writers, for journalists to actually make a living in this industry at the moment. it was like, well, you control their salaries. Like, let's leave that aside for now. But it's also absolutely true that if you do not have generational wealth, if you are not a Nepo baby or, you know, whatever within the media industry, you're going to be hustling every single day. I mean, that Ernest Hemingway stat is ridiculous.
Go on.
Who wants to quote Hemingway?
Well, just the fact that we've got Ernest Hemingway mentioned in the Media Voices podcast. Yay!
You've always been a disciple of the old man in the sea.
So, this is from this Defector piece. In 1936, Ernest Hemingway was paid a dollar a word. So if you adjust that for inflation, that's $21 a word in today's money. And the maximum, the maximum Kelsey McKinney, who's writing this piece, has ever been paid, right, for a glossy magazine, is $2 a word. Stay with me. She says no one, and she means no one, in media makes $21 a word. Barely people that make $21 an hour.
Even Boris Johnson didn't make that much per word of his column.
Oh, Dawn, why did you have to ruin everything?
Just to put this in perspective, I just this week got paid $75 US for 1,600 words and 5 hours research.
That's below minimum wage.
That is below minimum wage. Yeah, 100%. I knew that going in. I did it to get my foot in the door. But still, I mean, we can talk about this from the kind of how unfair it is that for us as writers. But it's inextricably linked, I think, to this lack of diversity in British media, which is both kind of ethical and commercial ramifications. And Esther, you've mentioned this lower down the notes, this piece from the National Association of Press Agencies.
Yeah, this was a story that came out in February that is it NAPA, N-A-P-A?
NAPA.
Okay, that's a cool acronym. So they actually said that there's going to be a huge agency rebellion over some freelance rates from News UK, which due to some anachronisms with the way that they do their billing, haven't changed the rates in 40 years.
That is insane. That is insanity.
Rup's got another marriage to pay for. He's just got engaged again. So what
is he?
Yeah, he's just got engaged again.
Oh, for goodness sake.
So he's got some bills, man.
He's got some balls and his defenders to go like, you know, this is, you know, they're casting this blame as they have for years and years on the platform. So it's the platform's taking away our money. But if you look at where the decline actually truly began, they haven't increased their freelance rates in 40 years. That is pre this collapse.
So I think this, Kelsey made this point in the piece that she put together. She said that like, nobody, well, you could argue nobody's as good as Hemingway. Like, most of us aren't Hemingway, right?
Well, speak for yourself.
But no writer today is even making half or a quarter of what he made, and writers only ever get so famous. And she said, if somebody was paid $5 a word in 2022, which is something she'd never heard of happening, that would be a quarter of what Hemingway was paid. But that writer would actually be able to pay rent, health insurance premiums, put some money in savings. Those people just don't exist. Unless, and this ties into a whole bigger issue, unless you've got your own Substack with like how many thousands of subscribers.
There is a lack of diversity that comes from that. And there is a lack of lower rungs for people, you know, from not wealthy backgrounds to get into the industry, which is a tragedy in its own right.
Soz.
but it's not just the idea that certain universities, it starts before that. You've got the proliferation of private school people. You've got there's a whole working class thing going on. There's the racial gender. It's just the whole way through. And it's that idea. It's not just about what people deserve to get paid. It's about what's the outputs. And the outputs don't represent the population anymore. I don't know if they did.
I just spoke to Rasmus Kleist Nielsen because he's got a book out with two other authors about news avoidance. And he said that one of the core reasons that they found why people avoid the news is because they have a lack of representation. They do not see their, you know, struggles, their desires represented in the media. So it has a commercial impact as well, which you would have thought would motivate people to get off their arse and do something about it.
But this is the thing, and I think this is what this piece was getting at, is that it's not that there isn't money in the industry. People can't sit there and say, oh, you know, these publishers are struggling, so salaries are low, so that's not the point. And I think I don't want to pick on Reach yet again, because I think this is about the fourth podcast in a row.
No, it's deservedly, because the NUJ called Reach out for exactly this.
And they said, oh, you know, salaries at Reach have completely stagnated for like a decade plus now, but the bonus, like at the same point they were cutting 700 jobs, the bonus is being paid out to the shareholders. We're in the multi-millions.
Yeah.
And this piece made the same thing. It's not that there's not money in Hollywood. There is shed loads of money in Hollywood, but millions and millions and millions of dollars are being paid out to just a couple of people at the top.
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm really going socialist.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say.
I think I honestly think my work here is done.
It's only taken 278 episodes, but yeah, finally we've recruited one to the cause, Peter.
But yeah, like there is so much, and there is a lot of money in publishing. There is a lot of money in streaming, in video, in Hollywood itself. It's just not trickling down, guys.
It's not.
Well, that's true of the world, Dory.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because there's a really good quote in that piece from Defector, which says, "The reality is that the people with the most money have devised at every turn new and more bulletproof ways for them to make and keep more money, and for the people who make things to make less. This is the eternal story of labor and management. It just has hot people in it." In this case,
we're talking about Hollywood here, not media, right? Certainly not. Well,
but yeah, that's exactly it. If you want journalism to flourish, you have to pay journalists. I mean, it's that simple, but at the same time, there are so many barriers to actually making that happen. There is some there is some positive news this week. Peter, why were you so... I thought the piece you did in the newsletter about this was actually really beautifully worded.
Well, thank you.
No,
I wish I'd been paid $1 a month for it. Well, earlier in the week, and again reported in our newsletter, or linked to from our newsletter, GB News announced losses of £76 million on the same day that Talk TV abandoned, can we say abandoned, linear broadcasting?
Bonfire of the vanity broadcasts.
Yeah, that just felt like good news. You know, Talk TV chasing peers off to YouTube.
Mm.
GB News racking up £76 million worth of losses. I mean, I think GB News is very different from Talk TV.
Right? Yeah, it is.
Talk
TV
is actually founded on a honest-to-God media organization.
Well, Talk Radio was, you know, has been around for ages at this point. That's
whether legit. whether you agree with the kind of political leanings of News Corp, you know, whatever, that's a serious news organization. GB News, on the other hand, I mean, it's funded by people with an agenda.
Yeah.
A right leaning. I'm avoiding right wing because
it's not just right wing. It's actively like alt-right at this point. They promote conspiracy theories. You know, they do have, you know, they've Ofcom finally seems to have found some teeth, and it's opened a couple of investigations into the fact that they just keep getting Tory politicians on and paying them hundreds of thousands of pounds. So it's less, I mean, let's be honest, it's not a news organization. It is the UK Fox News. That's the label that former chairman Andrew Neil outright rejected and then had to accept when he turned tail and fled from there. It very much does have an agenda here. So what is, if it's not making a profit, what, I mean, is it good news? I don't know, because are they just continuing to pay for that soft power or what's up?
Okay, so I cannot pretend to get into the head of some of these nut jobs. But to me, the project here is that if you move the fringe to that, there's a name for that, right?
The Overton window.
Yeah. And if you move the fringe to the center and everyone else moves in the other direction, your kind of loony views actually become closer to the mainstream. And that, to me, that's what these guys are trying to do. I don't know if that's true, but why would anyone else be spending this amount of money? I think, you know, what I said in the newsletter, why I took some joy in this, you know, it is enough to make you think there is a God, and that she is most definitely not an anti-woke, swivel-eyed, right-wing loon. Because these people are failing.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a question. What's happening to Piers Morgan? Because I thought... So he'd announced his departure a few weeks ago. He was going to go and, like, take
his show to
YouTube.
I think he's just taking the Talk TV show to YouTube.
But if Talk TV are now going streaming? Is Piers staying with them?
I think he's still with them, is he not? I thought he was.
I don't know. I have just tried to look this up, and it's really not clear. Like, is he still with them? Is they producing Piers Morgan Uncensored for YouTube? Because I thought he'd announced his departure. But because it was actually that he was actually leaving Talk TV.
I just thought he was taking the Talk TV show to YouTube as like the vanguard, as reconnaissance party for Talk TV to move on to YouTube.
I also still think this is less about, I mean, I think it does play a part, but I think this is less about the political angle that they took on it, and more that they were trying to launch a channel where, let's face it, nobody under 40 watches news on TV anymore. And if you're over 40, you're going to have had your established habits for decades. It would take like the threshold to actually switch that habit, you know, that 10 o'clock news, watching that 10 o'clock news, to a different channel is quite a high threshold. And they sort of seem to realize that, oh, actually, no young people are turning on their TV and pressing a news channel at 10 o'clock at night anymore. We're streaming, we're watching on YouTube, we're much more kind of not tied to the TV. So, yeah, I think it's just the thing that the audience they were targeting is not going to switch, and the younger audience just aren't watching TV that way anymore.
I don't know. A lot of the nut jobs are on YouTube all the time, right?
Oh, my God, yeah, all the time. We're looking at those losses for GB News, right? There is potentially an angle here that they're paying for soft power. You know, they're not approaching this as a kind of purely commercial thing. They are paying for influence, Peter, to move the Overton window, as you said. Yep. But if you wanted to be a little bit ballsy, you could say that if they don't, having had years to do it, achieve their aim of keeping the Tories in power past the next election, at what point do the backers start going, this is not a worthwhile investment commercially or politically? And, you know, when do they pull the plug? Is it kind of a no soft power, no point type situation? I guess we'll see. And the next
That's
year.
A conspiracy theory I can get.
I would also just say from my obviously decades of experience in watching media companies grow, I think there is an awful lot that is pulled quite quickly without really giving it a chance to get established. Like for brands like this, you need a 3 to 5 year runway. And they are only, what, GB News is 2 years old now?
Oh God, it feels like it's been a blight landscape for far longer than that.
I think we all need a few more years to see whether the investment pays off in establishing it.
That's, you know, a very measured approach to that. So,
well,
the other thing that's interesting with GB News is all their growth is online. Yeah. All their growth is digital.
So, I mean, again, so, could they follow? Could they follow Talk TV and just go online only?
Got a real rosy glow about that.
Well, at the moment, you're right, Esther, that their audience is probably still watching the TVs, or certainly a large part. Oh, I heard the best statistic the other day. So someone was talking about how long Rishi should delay the election, and they were saying, well, you know, the smart money's on as long as humanly possible because it can only get better. But this guy came on and said one of the problems is for them is that statistically the Tory party loses something like 30,000 voters a month because of death. And I had to go check. So apparently in the UK, there's about 600,000 people die a year. And if you think about, you know, the split there, yeah, it probably is about 30,000. That was a wild start.
That is crazy, yeah.
Not all of those people would have voted Tory. Not all of those people would have voted, surely.
Older people are more inclined to vote. Older people are more inclined to vote Tory.
Oh, yeah, I'm not debating that. I just think that figure is a bit too high.
Is it the 30,000 then is the proportion of total people who die who would have voted Tory? You know what I mean? That's like, it's not the total figure.
Yeah, I'm sure they don't check people's party membership cards as they cart them off.
I'm not sure that that's true in this country. I fully believe that they would.
And maybe it's not 30,000, but it was thousands. This week I spoke to Shepo Chabalala, project manager and team lead at the LSE's Journalism AI project. We spoke about use cases and the benefits of AI in smaller newsrooms and how collaboration is helping journalists get on board the AI rocket ship. I've almost said bandwagon, but I thought rocket ship sounded way more positive. But before we get into all that, I asked Sheppo what the Journalism AI Project actually is.
My name is Tepwa Chabalala, and I am the project manager and team lead at Journalism AI. So essentially what I do is I oversee all the programs that we run at Journalism AI, as well as the research that we do.
Just for people that don't know, what is the Journalism AI Project? Where has it come from? What's it trying to achieve?
So the Journalism AI Project or initiative is a project of the London School of Economics and Political Science, and it is supported by the Google News Initiative. And essentially, it grew or stemmed from a research project that we did back in 2019, where we tried to understand how newsrooms were using AI. And so from that research, we were able to build the programs that we currently have. And so essentially, right now, we have three programs. The first one is called The Discovery, where it's an introductory course to AI. It's a newsletter course over a 6 weeks period, and you learn all the basics through a newsletter that you get in your inbox every week. The second is what we call the Academy for Small Newsrooms, and that is a sort of a regional program where we work with 20 newsrooms at a time who are trying to or thinking about using AI in the newsrooms. And so for 6-8 weeks, we have subject matter experts coming on to do a module with them, as well as a workshop. And so that's sort of 20 newsrooms over 8 weeks regionally that we run throughout the year. And then our third program is the fellowship program, where we work with newsrooms that are already established in their thinking and implementation of AI. And the idea for them is to come up with a AI solution for the respective newsrooms, but they do that in collaboration with other newsrooms. And so you'll have an editorial person with a tech person working together with another editorial and tech person from another newsroom, working on an AI solution that they could implement in the newsrooms over an 8-month period. And so those are three programs. And then last year, we introduced what we call Journalism AI Connect. And it's a Slack space where people could come together and interact, learn from each other, ask questions, and share knowledge within this AI space, because we are all learning. And at Journalism AI, we don't claim to be the experts. And so Connect is a way of sharing that knowledge across sort of the playing field. And of course, we do research. And so in the beginning, remember I said that our project grew from this research that we did in 2019. And so last year, we updated that research with a new report called Generating Change, really, again, trying to understand 5 years on, trying to understand where newsrooms are with or were with AI in that sense.
So I want to come back to that report in more detail in a second. But first off, I'm really interested. You just said that you guys are not the experts, but I'm really interested to know how you came to the project. What's your background?
Ooh, my background. My background is financial journalism. So having worked in various newsrooms in South Africa, most of them either international or Pan-African. So I'm from South Africa. So yeah, worked for Reuters, Business Day, Forbes Africa magazine. And then a couple of years after the newsroom, I moved into media development. So I worked for a project at a university as well from South Africa called JAMLab, the Journalism and Media Lab. And essentially we were documenting innovations in media and journalism across the African continent, because at the time when we started the project, there wasn't anything like it. So you have the Nieman Lab, you have the Reuters Institute documenting journalism and media in Europe and the rest of the world, but there was nothing like it on the African continent. And so that's how JAMLab came up. And so I did that for a couple of years until I came to the UK, and then this opportunity came to join Journalism AI. And I was like, well, something new, let me try it. And so it's been a year now, actually. This month marks a year of being with the project. So yeah, that's my background in a nutshell.
Was your interest specifically in AI, or was it more in technology generally?
My interest is more in technology generally and working with newsrooms. And so I think from that experience of having worked with newsrooms in Africa, I think it was a sort of a natural progression to sort of bog down and just focus on a niche. And so I guess with where the world was going, I guess AI was sort of the perfect niche to sort of focus on because it has so many other touch points, which sort of makes it challenging and interesting as well.
I guess if you've been there for a year, so you must have arrived just after OpenAI properly hit the headlines. Is that right?
Yes. So I joined the project in February. So OpenAI made the announcement in November 2022. Uh-huh. Yeah. So like 3 months. Yeah. 3 months. And so it was like a roller coaster, trying to learn the job, trying to understand the field and understand who the players are, but also serving our audience and our newsrooms that need help. It's sort of been a roller coaster. I'm also trying to put together this research as well at the same time. It was like quite a challenging year, but really good, good space for growth and for learning, which I really appreciate.
And in some ways, it's like the perfect timing, and in some ways, it's the worst timing in the world.
Exactly. Look, the growth doesn't happen in a comfortable space. And so I needed the discomfort to grow a bit, yeah.
Definitely. Okay, so this report, you put the 2023 report out in September, and that was really trying to update the original work that had been done back in 2018, is that correct?
2019.
What's the big takeaway? I mean, the change in that five-year period has got to be incredible. What's your biggest takeaways from that report?
The biggest takeaway is that about 80% of newsrooms that we interviewed. So let me just go back a few steps. So in this new report, we interviewed or spoke to 105 newsrooms from 46 countries. And so we did in-depth interviews with all of them. And so for the first time, we really made sure that we had representation from South America, from Africa, from Asia, and it wasn't a report that solely focused, or at least it improved the focus or the newsrooms that were represented in 2019. Whereas back in 2019, a huge representation was from the Americas and Europe. This year, we made sure that it was balanced. And so we had about sort of 20-24% of newsrooms from each part from each region of the world. And the biggest takeaways from that report, sort of quickly in a nutshell, is that we learned that there's rapid experimentation with and in the incorporation of generative AI, especially in that, you know, it came in 2020, we did the report, or at least the data collection, around March, April, May, June. And so in that, we were learning that a lot of newsrooms were starting to experiment with generative AI. Another thing we learned from the newsrooms is that there was a key concern about the ethical integration of AI and also a question about upholding journalistic values within newsrooms, which is a challenge a lot of organizations are facing. I guess the beauty of having to try to make sure that there was good representation, we learned that AI adoption is unevenly distributed across the world. And you'll see that adoption is a lot higher in the Western markets and a lot lower when you go to South America, Asia, and Africa. And then lastly, but fourthly, and it's something that we saw in a previous report that came through again this time around, is the need for transparency from both the tech companies, but also from news organizations in how we use AI. And then second to that is collaboration, the need to collaborate, learn from each other, and obviously sort of the literacy or growing the literacy of AI amongst journalists and as well as newsrooms.
So I'm guessing that sort of uneven distribution, you know, particularly in the Global South, comes from the fact that the technology is more concentrated, particularly in America, I guess. But are there any other reasons that it's harder for newsrooms away from the US and Europe to adopt AI?
I mean, there are various reasons. And then, you know, some of them are, for example, they go back to infrastructure. A lot of the countries do not have the technical expertise, or rather infrastructure. The adoption of internet isn't as prevalent as it is in other Western countries. Tech skills was a key one. Where, you know, a lot of newsrooms don't have the technical expertise within the newsroom already to facilitate that adoption or that faster adoption of AI. Thirdly was resources. A lot of news organizations are already struggling to become sustainable. And so AI adding another dimension or element to that made it sort of challenging in that respect. Whereas you'll see that AI adoption in most newsrooms is bigger newsrooms who have the resources, who have the tech and the infrastructure to support the AI adoption, whereas a lot of newsrooms in the global south are having sort of challenges with that already.
So that the idea of collaboration and shared learning, shared knowledge, is your focus on sort of helping people jumpstart in a situation where they're behind because they have less resource or they have less access to tech skills? Is your role to try and jumpstart their adoption of AI?
It's not necessarily to jumpstart the adoption of AI, but to be aware of it. It's really just sharing knowledge and then with the hope that they can decide thereafter what they do with that knowledge. And so the discovery is that, and the academy is sharing a bit more knowledge with people who are already thinking about adopting AI. And obviously the fellowship is working with people who have already adopted AI and facilitating sort of bigger and better, experimentation and adoption. And so, yeah, we don't really force down anybody's throats, but the idea is to, start thinking about it, start learning about it, because once a technology is out of the box, you cannot put that back in. And so the idea is play with it and see what it can and cannot do for you. And then from that point on, you are knowledgeable enough to decide whether it's for you or not. In essence, that's what we do. It's more knowledge sharing than anything.
In some of the conversations I've had around AI, bigger organizations tend to think, from the staff in mega organizations, they see it as a kind of top down, you have to use this, and maybe see it more as a threat. Whereas smaller organizations tend to see it as an opportunity. Do you think that's fair?
Yes and no, because from the research, we learned that there were some people who, for example, were using AI platform, mostly generative AI platforms, for themselves, where the newsroom hadn't had a policy yet on their usage of AI. And so you'd have a little typo there who sits at his desk and uses ChatGPT to refine a headline or whatever. You know, so in that way, they used it for themselves to help them with their work, even though there wasn't a policy in place already. Whereas in some news organizations, they had guidelines in place already, and they were able to guide the journalists in how to use the AI in the newsroom using the various technologies that they had adopted already. So it really varies based on the respective newsrooms. And I don't think it's a smaller or large newsroom. I think the difference is what we learned as well is that the smaller newsrooms have bigger room to experiment, whereas the larger traditional newsrooms don't have that space. They're more traditional, more bureaucratic, so it's a lot more difficult to even think about experimenting or using AI. Whereas other newsrooms that are bigger or smaller, where they have thought of or started using AI, it's a lot easier, they're more nimble and flexible in how they adopt or think about using AI. So it all varies from newsrooms. So there isn't a sort of a black and white, bigger newsrooms do this, smaller newsrooms do this. So it's really about speaking to the individuals and the respective newsrooms to really understand how or where does the adoption begin in that newsroom.
Is there any, do you see any trends within those experiments? Is there certain areas that people are spending more time on?
I mean, look, we are still at the early stages of really perfecting the usage of generative AI in the newsroom. So a lot of people are using it to rewrite headlines, to rewrite paragraphs of content or articles to refine their writing, to do a bit of editing as well. Then you will have some people who are in the tech space within the newsroom using it to refine the coding. And so it's, we're still in the early stages where newsrooms are experimenting and trying to figure out how best to use generative AI in the newsroom. And so part of our work this year is to go back to the newsrooms that we interviewed last year and say, let's sit down and let's see how else are you actually using this? What are the best use cases that you're picking up in a newsroom with generative AI?
And once you've done that research, what do you do with it? Do you share it?
Definitely. So it's open, it's free. We share it on our website and people can really look at it and see whether this is something that they can adopt in the newsroom or not. But essentially the idea is to share that information with newsrooms.
If someone just comes along and, I don't know, sends you an email and says, okay, I'm interested in getting started on this, what's your advice? Where do you tell them to start?
We have what we call the Journalism AI Starter Pack. So essentially, I will tell you to go there. You'll find it on journalismai.info. And essentially, the Starter Pack is designed to help individuals or news organizations learn about the opportunities that are offered by AI. It's a guide, really, that anybody can use, but it's sort of targeted at small and local publishers. And so we created, it's a Google Doc, and so we created sections people can skip and click on the links that work for them. And so that's a sort of a good place to start. In every section, there's a couple of more links that people can click on, take to other websites where you can learn more about journalism and AI. So I feel like that's a good starting point. And then obviously we have the Slack channel where people can join and ask questions and somebody will answer them. So I feel like those two are sort of good starting points if you're thinking about using AI. Of course, there are other programs around there, but I will promote the ones that you offer.
Yeah, you're allowed to give an advert for what you guys do. And then I guess the next thing is if they're interested and they think they can see an application, the next thing is to sign up for that email course. Is that right? Is that the way it would go?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So if people or folks sign up to our newsletter, we don't spam you. We send it sort of almost at least once a month. And so that's the best way to know when we run our programs. And so we'll share in a couple of weeks' time how we're running those programs. And best case scenario, yeah, sign up for the discovery. That's open to everybody, which is nice. So anybody can sign up. And then we'll have Brandon coming along to sort of help with answering all the questions. So the beauty of Discovery that I didn't share is we've got a Slack channel where you can ask the course creator questions about the module that we've just learned. And so that's another sort of feature where you have that custom support if need be. And so, sign up to the newsletter and we can share all those details there. And then obviously those who are more advanced can sign up to the Discovery. We run various iterations of that program in a year. And then obviously, if we do not satisfy you, we can share links to other courses that are out there.
After a year of doing this, are you, I was going to say optimistic. I'm not sure that's the right word. Do you see some really practical applications being developed? Is this helping people do a better job?
I'm always optimistic.
yeah, I've met you a few times. You're always smiling.
I'm always optimistic. And I think, once you understand that with anything, there'll be those who use it for good and those who use it for bad. Yeah. And so I'm always looking at the good side to say, listen, yes, let's use it for good. But in the back of your mind, know that you are sort of challenging or working against others who are using it for bad. And so there'll always be this back and forth force between the two. But yes, I think a lot of people will try to figure out what's the best case scenario. Obviously, the newsrooms who are already or have implemented or used LLMs, large language models, within the newsrooms already, for one form or another. But generative AI, of course, has brought in a new element that wasn't there before. And so in the next couple of months, year, we'll get to see use cases of how newsrooms are actually using it. I remember, I think the Daily Maverick, for example, in South Africa, are using it to summarize their articles. And so you can go to their website and see a summary of, so they write long form pieces. And so using a generative AI plugin, they're able to summarize, say, their articles for the audiences. And so you see those newsrooms doing that. So they're not necessarily using it to write articles, but they're using it to create platforms that are engaging and that have users staying longer on their websites. And so a summary is like one of those things that says, oh, here's a quick rundown of what we've published. You can read two paragraphs on this article and then move on. So I think, yeah, you'll see sort of use cases like that and others, where others, for example, are trying to build chatbots that interact with their archives or, you know, as a journalist, as you're producing an article, or one, a chatbot that users can use that interacts with the content on your website. So we'll see sort of various use cases in the coming months as people sort of get to grips with what the technology is and what it can and cannot do. The challenge with it as well is that it keeps changing at such a rapid pace. Like we saw a couple of weeks back, Google updated their generative AI platform called Bard. Now it's called Gemini, with a bit more changes in it. And so, you know, we'll see those changes coming along as we sort of move along the cycle of this hype of generative AI.
So my last question for you, and among all this crazy hype, how do you stay up to date? How do you stay on top of what's going on?
I read, and I read a lot. I try to read everything and anything that comes my way. I've signed up to a couple of newsletters as well that I sort of have become my go-to. It's just, and I talk to people as well, you know, attending conferences as well. Just to stay abreast with what's happening, what people are doing. I feel like it's my responsibility to make sure I know what's going on out there and be able to share that with everybody. On the Slack channel called Journalism AI Connect, people also share resources. So that's another way of how I stay sort of connected. But the beauty of us being Journalism AI and sharing the knowledge, once in a while, we curate a newsletter of resources that are worth reading. What we read, we also share with the community to make sure that people stay abreast. So if people sign up to the newsletter, they're able to sort of keep updated with the very sort of high level key things that are important. It saves you from trolling the internet like I do, finding articles. But yeah, it's mostly reading and talking to people all the time to make sure that, I stay updated.
So you read it all so the rest of us don't have to.
Exactly. Put it in a nutshell, yes.
So as Chris said at the top of the episode, do you like that? That sounds really podcasty. We have a daily newsletter that shares the kind of stories that we've been talking about. We share those stories every day. Just the top four, the ones that we think are the most important for you, as I said many, many times, to show off to your colleagues and to your boss to make you look really clever in front of your media colleagues. If you want to look really clever, sign up for a curated daily newsletter at voices.media. Do it now.
And entries are open for the Publisher Podcast Awards until the end of this week. They close on Friday, the 15th of March. You can go to publisherpodcasts.com to enter for free. And then next Monday, the 18th of March, entries are opening for the Publisher Newsletter Awards. So if you have got a brilliant publisher podcast, get your skates on. If you've got a brilliant publisher newsletter, you've got a little bit more time. You can go to publishernewsletters.com to enter that.
Very nice. And get your entries in as soon as you possibly can. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest and hopefully slightly more apolitical look, maybe, at the media landscape.
Unless someone comes along and offers us $21 a watt.
Even if it was the sun.
No.
Nope.
Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.